everybody is important. Everybody has a story to tell. In a sense, when you want to talk in a political sense about equality, what you're saying is people, everyone's equal. Everyone's important. Everyone has something to offer to the society. And everyone should have the opportunity to offer it. I mean, if my political feelings come out of any sort of sense of my literary sensibility, then that's it. It's that sense of trying to give voice to the voiceless. You can take that on a political level as well as on a poetic level. That's what it is.
From Nova Scotia's Black community, that was the voice of George Eliot Clark, poet, journalist, community organizer. This is Rock Meets Bone. I'm Brian Guns. When George Eliot Clark first visited Weymouth Falls as an 18-year-old city boy from Halifax, he was enchanted and moved by the warmth and community spirit he discovered there. It was to be 7 years before he returned to Weymouth Falls. During that time, he graduated from the University of Waterloo in English and Journalism and published his first book of poetry, Saltwater Spirituals and Deeper Blues, which won the Writers' Federation of Nova Scotia Annual Poetry Award in 1983. When he went back to Weymouth Falls as a man of 25, it was to a very different world. As a community development worker, he helped to organize the protest against the acquittal of the man who killed Graham Cromwell. As he worked in Weymouth Falls and came to know its beauty and its suffering, George Clark began to compose stories, poems, and blues based on the lives and voices of that community. The writing in this program comes from Weymouth Falls Suite, published in New Maritimes magazine, and Work in Progress. George Eliot Clark.
I started saying, geez, you know, these are things that should be heard, that need to be written about, so that people know that this is what people have done here. But I also hope it's universal, because I don't see this as just simply being about the Black community. I see this as being about communities, about human nature, about human beings getting along, not getting along, falling into love, dying, all those kinds of things, because that's what our lives are all about. That's what our experience is all about. And I've set that in the Black community, and I've looked at our culture, Afro-Nova Scotian culture, as a means of expressing that. But I'm hoping that the things that I'm talking about here, other people can relate to. This is called In the Field. And it's a haiku, but it happens to tell a story at the same time, although I believe that haiku generally tells stories. It's a very compact way of telling stories because it's basically an image, and the image itself, like a photograph, can tell a story. You can read a lot into a photograph, and that's how I see haiku. That's how I read it, and this little piece is meant to sit all by itself to tell a story, in a sense. So again, it's called In the Field. Sila glares at me impatiently, not seeing the apple blossoms. And that's it. it's very brief, but that's one of my favorite pieces because I think it does tell a story about a relationship, if you read it in the context of all the other pieces as well, and also just about ways of seeing things, about people looking at things. Looking at nature, some people see nature, some people don't see nature, or they're thinking about other things rather than what's around them. Although on the other hand, and this is a two-edged sword too, the speaker here could be taken as being someone who is so preoccupied with abstractions that he can't see human relationships or what's important to the other person in this piece. So I left it ambivalent in that way. Weymouth Falls to me, this is a really deep question for me personally, because it's a place that I discovered because I never knew it existed, which doesn't make any sense, I know. But it's sort of like, it's a black community in Nova Scotia. It's been around since 1815. My own background's from a black community in Windsor Plains, Nova Scotia. That's where I was born. I grew up in Halifax in the black community here in the North End. But I never really realized that there were yet other communities. I knew about the Prestons and so on because they're so close to Halifax and they're almost part of the metropolitan area, and they're fast becoming that now with all the expansion that's going on in Dartmouth. But as a teenager, it was just sort of, it was just a real surprise to me to realize that there were these other communities that existed in the province, and particularly Weymouth Falls, because the first time I went down there, it was really magical. There was this fellow I was traveling with, his name was Enos Crawford. We stayed at his grandmother's place in Weymouth Falls. I'll never forget that. It was my first time there. And it was snowing. And it was cold. It was in November of 78. His grandmother gave me this room, and they had this bed with so many quilts on it. It was just impossible to believe. But it was really, really comfortable and really nice. It was like all these quilts. And I just laid there and watched the snow come down in the moonlight outside. And it was really, it just struck me as being a very magical place. Although, I mean, that's probably a very romantic view, because there are lots of things that are harsh and oppressive too that people have to go through. But yet at the same time, there was this warmth and there was this fellowship and community feeling as well that I felt there and experienced there. How to live in the garden. One of the things in the Bible that one of the commandments that God gave was for man to keep the garden of Eden and to take care of it. And I saw the preparation of food as being part of that spiritual command of keeping the garden of Eden. And this is how you live in the garden. It's preparing the food and thinking about it and taking your time with it and all of that. So this piece was for that, to recognize the nobility of that and the faith and beauty and power of that. So how to live in the garden. And it begins with a quotation from Genesis. And the Lord God took the man and put him into the Garden of Eden to dress it and to keep it. Korah brings a rural nobility to making food, a solid love, staring into a huge aluminum pot like a gardener glancing into a pot of lush earth, bright soil, glistening with newness, or tending a bonsai tree, the trunk of steam rooted in the pottage, the branches of steam wafting into nothingness. She salts her stored miniature sea, churns it with a wooden spoon, then lifts goodness like a kiss to her lips, while spicy smells green her kitchen into Eden. Cooking is motherhood, faith. Korah opens her antique cookbook, a private Bible, enumerating imperial measures, English orders, pinches, pecks, cups, teaspoons of this or that, and intones, I create not food but love. The table is a community. Plates are round roofs, glasses, iced trees, cutlery, silver streams. Her Digby County cuisine, mixing in the salty recipes of Fundy Acadians, the starchy diets of South Shore loyalists, and the trout tastes of colored refugees, includes rapier pie, impossible pie, baked cabbage, mackerel boiled in vinegar, and basic black and blue berries. For breakfast, Korah offers fried eggs, sausages, orange marmalade, and toast, washed down with rich coffee. Her tastes are eccentric, exotic, eclectic. Her carrot cake consists of whole carrots whose green leafy tops sprout from brown earth and icing, and whose orange roots taper to the cake's floor. She bakes apple trees, leaves, blossoms, seeds, and bark into her apple pies. Korah is the concrete poet of food. This afternoon, she thawed a pound of cod fillet, white flesh raw but succulent, on the plate and diced it into 1-inch squares. Then she sauteed a half cup of filleted onions in rich yellow butter and poured the sizzling scents into a broth made from celery soup, a cup of water, and a cup of milk. Next, she stirred the mix and added the fish, Digby scallops, and Church Point clams, nursing the melange to a boil. Korah simmered it for 7 minutes, then sprinkled smiling happiness with chopped parsley. Voila! Perfection under gravity. Korah's dandelion wine is a great agony of sunflowers. No, dandelions. It must be drunk to be believed. One believes it when drunk. It tastes like Russian or Chinese literature. It curls into a glass, snarls along the sides and bottom, doubling, tripling, quadrupling upon itself. Watch the white curl of cream churn into clear brown tea, touch bottom, then billow along the sides and up, muddying the water. And by the way, that recipe in there for the cod fillet is real. You can follow it and it works. Okay. This is a cliche, but it's true, like most cliches. Religion is part of the fabric of Black Nova Scotian culture. I mean, like most of us, I grew up in the Black Baptist Church. Even though I'm sort of lapsed now, I mean, all those Sunday school classes and having to sit through services with my parents and so on made their impression. I still remember fidgeting in church and stuff like that. It wasn't really one of my favorite experiences, but it was something we had to go through. It was expected of us, but looking back on it, it wasn't that bad. It was okay. It certainly imbued me with a sense of the spiritual and of the religious, particularly the singing, which I found very scary as a child. Actually, all these huge voices rolling over us, adult voices in the back, seemed to always be in the back, just right behind us, coming up, this huge roar of voices singing these slightly mournful songs. Not spirituals, these were hymns, but they always seemed to have a mournful tinge to them, at least in my imagination, my memory of hearing them as a child at Koala Street Baptist. And very, very somber, very, again, tinged with sadness in these voices. I don't know, like when I think of Canada, this is going to sound strange because I don't think most people think about this way, but when I think about Canadian music, I think that the music that is most indigenous to this place is music like music by folk singers and gospel music and so on. So I just think that it relates to the kind of lives that people led. Maybe it's not true anymore in urban centers. I'm sure that's not the music of Toronto, for instance, or even maybe perhaps now of Halifax. But it's always the music that I related to most, of just very, very simple music, but yet I think very profound music. It's just some guitars, somebody with a harmonica, somebody with a banjo, perhaps. This sounds like a cliche, but as to me, that's the most heartfelt. Someone with a fiddle, that's the most heartfelt kind of music. That has had a big influence on my poetry. I like to think that one of the big influences on me has been folk music, has been blues, has been music that people make out of their surroundings, as they have, that's all that they have to express what they are feeling, but yet those feelings are universal. And in that sense, it tends to me to seem to be more honest or direct. Maybe honest isn't the right word, but direct than other forms of music. Okay, this is a piece called Sela's Elegant Blues. The fat moon is white, sorta like your eyes. The butter moon is bright, sugar, kinda like your eyes. And it melts like I melt for you as it coasts across the sky. The black highway unthreads like your body do sometimes. The long highway unwinds, baby, like your lovin' do sometimes. I'm gonna swerve your curves and ride your center line. Stars are dripping like tears. The highway moves like a hymn. Stars are dripping like tears, mama. The highway sways like a hymn. And I reach for your love, beautiful, like a cat burglar reaches for a gem. I am trying to record the way some people have said certain things, and the voices of religion and music are particularly important because they are means that people use to express themselves and to express culture. And there is, of course, more, in a sense, sophisticated voices as well. And I want to give voice to that culture, too, before it disappears, which I think it's in danger of, I think that's a danger. I think that's going to happen in the next 20 years. When we look at the rural Black communities now in Nova Scotia, we see communities made up of the very young and the very old. and most of the mature people are off somewhere else in Halifax, Toronto, Calgary, even working for a living or whatever. And I think that's going to lead, unfortunately and terribly, to the potential disappearance of some of those communities. And I don't want that to happen. I don't think that should happen. I hope that we can restore some kind of economy to those communities so people can afford to stay, and so on. But if it does happen, I want there to be some kind of record of what kind of culture we had, or, well, we still have, but I want there to be some kind of record of it for the future in case it can't last. Okay. I think what I'd like to read now is this little piece I call The Argument. It's about this fellow who I've given the name to of Saul Clements. And this is based on a true-to-life situation, like sitting down and talking to this old couple in Windsor Plains, Nova Scotia, actually. She, at this time, this was back in 86, then she was 76, and the gentleman she was with was 106. Truly, 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 I kid you not. And they just, I just happened to wander into their home, actually, just quite by accident, doing a survey for the Black Cultural Center. They just basically forced me to sit down and start telling me their life stories. And I was so engrossed, I just sat there and listened. Anyway, it's called The Argument. Saul Clements, may God have mercy on his soul. His love became a series of effortless mistakes. He was born a laborer in a century that hates work. He spent all he is gouging coal out of a hillside so his lungs are silver-coated with sickness, and his heart dries now to bone and his conscience is rusted metal. Who dast blame this man if he makes a stepdaughter his lover and his wife his foe? Yet, jury of readers, there is no defense for these social crimes. These sins are Mr. Clements's own. True, he has been sinned against. 50 years is too long to spend stooped like a hunchback in a damp, vicious cave dark with smoke and tuberculosis, shoveling coal just for the pennies to fix one's shoes. So, folks, our hands are dirty. As surely as antifreeze and coal dust, we've helped to poison him. But it's too late for our tears. Besides, he is tired of hope. His nerves are calloused. He has shoveled his life away like coal. So focus the camera on his face as lined as the pages of a book. Close up on his hands, huge mitts that can harm easily, calloused gloves that heft coal. He resembles our dream of Samson. His speech is gravel. The scene dissolves into the interior of a modest hidden home. James Brown wails, prisoner of love, from an antique radio. Old Saul Clements comes into focus, lying in a disturbed bed beside his young stepdaughter, Missy Jarvis. He sits up. His radio shifts abruptly into Anything by Patsy Cline. So I'm hoping that people, when people come to this and read it, that they will walk away saying, yeah, that I know what that's about. I know people who've gone through similar experiences. So I've tried to be more reflective, more of a mirror of things that go on in communities. In this particular suite, in the material that appeared in New Maritimes, it was difficult to try to give a full sense of the story that I'm trying to unfold, which actually is a series of stories. But I hope that the full piece will give readers a sense of drama and a sense of story. Basically, the finished piece that I have in my mind right now on paper consists of 7 parts, a series of different love relationships, and a murder story as well, and the impact of that murder on a community. So I hope that the piece does tell a story overall in the end. But the main thing that it does is tell about the life of a community. And also, I think that it addresses the questions, or not the question, rather, but the common and constant problem or question of what is beautiful and how do we deal with pain? Beauty and pain, I see as being the two poles of human existence. And that really is the theme of this thing all the way through. I came back to Nova Scotia and lived here for 2 years, 85 to 87. And shortly after I came back, this incident occurred in Weymouth Falls, and it involved the death of a man who I knew, although not well. That weekend in June 85 was a particularly bad weekend for Black Nova Scotians. There was a terrible accident that occurred where two people were involved that are well known in the Black community, and people were reflecting on that and thinking about that and expressing sorrow over that accident which had occurred, a car accident. And then that same weekend, this fellow in Weymouth Falls dies violently, a shotgun wound to the thigh, and just bleeds to death after crawling out to the middle of a roadway with all these people standing around watching him bleed to death. People felt very peculiar. It was very strange. It was like all this happened in one weekend, June 8th, June 9th, 1985. People felt very funny about this. It took a little while for it to click, but I wasn't there at the time, but Weymouth Day, which is July 1st in Weymouth, Nova Scotia, people in the Black community were saying how they were just waiting for somebody to say something. There's going to be a huge fight that day at the baseball field. They're just waiting for somebody just to walk by and say something, because people felt that strongly about what had happened. But everybody said, no, we'll wait. We'll let justice take its course. We'll see what happens in the courts and so on. And so nothing happened until October that year, when the fellow who was accused was acquitted. And then people just burst with all of this anger. And it was very ugly. It was a very ugly time. People were walking around and talking about tension and talking about wanting to pick up a gun and go and do something, just get it over with, just give me a gun, I'll go and do it. We've got a plan. I mean, there was all this sort of talk that was going on. This guy was important. He wasn't just a guy who got into fights. He wasn't just a guy who got drunk. He wasn't just a guy who worked at the lumber mill. He was a guy that people liked. He was a great singer. He had a child son. He was a human being. King Lear in Wyla Falls. And this is again about a murder. This is about the murder of Othello Clements. Although it's a foreview of that murder by the speaker's sort of foresight that this was going to happen to this character who happens to be called Othello, although it's not the same Othello as Shakespeare's. But I haven't liked the name, so I filched it. Anyway, this is the speaker imagining Othello as King Lear in this place. So it's called King Lear in Wyla Falls. Snow-bearded, sable-faced, our Lear stumbles through ruins of corn, interrogates the crows, and reels, ragging his majesty on brambles. Fallen maple leaves tangle in his hair. He drains a glass and moans, this road's too tough. He wants to walk beside the Atlantic, to sound the wrinkling and remorseless deep that shut over the head of Lycidas, to plunge his brain in brine, to face Mizzle, to make an aquarium of his brain, to be paralyzed by draft or sour ale, to scrabble beside the weeping river in strange penance under the racket and turmoil of gulls. Let Othello sleep now. Lay him down, oceaned in silk sheets and woolen blankets covered with a rose quilt, a glimpse of death, the poor sadness of pine which encloses. This fallen majesty wears a rouged crown of sere leaves, withered berries, and vines. He hates him that would upon the rack of this hard world stretch him out longer. Blanket Othello with roses, he will be beautiful in death. Then let's walk beside the Sisabu and sit on rocks and weep for all humanity. So that's King Lear, Wild of Falls. But it was just this general feeling of, I guess what I was fighting against, what we were fighting against, was feeling like, you guys don't count. You guys get killed, who cares? You guys, something happens to you guys, no one's worried about it. You don't count. You don't matter. And in a sense, that's what my writing this stuff is all about, too, saying that, well, we do count. We do matter. We do have stories to tell. Our lives are important. His life was important. His mom's life's important. His brothers and sisters are important. That, I mean, that's a very simple statement, but that's a radical statement in the context of a culture which says that you're not important, that you don't count, that you're menial, that you're marginal, that we can tear down your houses a la Africville and move you away, and no one's going to worry about it because you're an eyesore, and it's a blight on the urban environment, and all those nice sociological phrases. But that was the milieu, that was the environment, that was the energy that drove me to say that this has to be documented, not in an anthropological sense or sociological sense, but just like that these people existed and that these are the emotions they felt and this is why they felt them. This is the motivation for this work. And this piece is about a character I call Pablo, who's thinking about a woman whose name is Amarantha, and he's walking home after seeing her, and he's thinking about her and thinking about the nature around him as well at night. And this is what that piece is trying to reflect. So, Amarantha, Maranatha. Orange jack-o'-lantern moon glowers. I stumble this night-flooded road, wishing on Am. Her long ebony hair glistens in twisting vines. Her wrist's liquid curve tumbles darkly in clouds. The stream rushes over her voice. She be freedom. Can I get a witness? I'll dance the arc of core in the leap of water, cause I spy Am in night's sharp plunge and pitch and roll of hay, mannerisms of creatures caught in the act, leaping for the privacy of bushes. Crickets crack a juicy tune, and Am's hair tumbles like a nun's black habit, and wild rose petals rain like blood on a wheat field. Why should I croon the blues of every lover since song began? To reach out and kiss Am even once would be the best life possible under the sun, when morning jumps. Now this barbed wire is a vine of dark grapes, the moon a great bowl, the pines bedposts, and I've sprouted giant wings and a long beard, and Am's words have become plums and chrysanthemums, and her pronunciation gold butterflies. I'm gonna drink the moon's milky ouzo and then sip a gold glass of the sun's scotch, and when Am awakes, we'll dance in each other. What I was trying to react against was to say, no, these people are important, and here are their stories to express that importance, good and bad, beautiful and painful.
We'd like to thank George Eliot Clark for his readings and reflections. Rock Meets Bone is produced with the assistance of the Naropa Institute of Canada. Thanks for listening.